slowly. Maybe I'll start by asking you all, how many of you have had instructions in meditation before? And how many of you are brand new to meditation? Mm-hmm. And how many of you have had meditation instruction before, done meditation before, have not done this particular kind of mindfulness meditation? Mm-hmm. And, okay. I was, I live up in, on Skyline, up above Palo Alto. Now, I don't know what the weather was like down here today, but up there it poured the whole day. And it was pouring still today when I came down now. And there was something very nice about the first day of full rain up there in the season. And then coming down here to talk about meditation. I think that the perhaps the rain up there, the mood that I had, wasn't exactly melancholy, but a very intimate, kind of at-home feeling that just came with being at home and feeling the rain. And I associate meditation with a kind of at-homeness and holding experience warmly, closely to oneself, within oneself, kind of being at home with oneself, in oneself, which I think is very much different than how many of us live our lives, and very different from the way that much influence in our culture gets us to live our lives. I think that the work life, the school life, has a lot of pressures in our life, and so we're constantly losing touch with ourselves, in a sense. And our mind races around, trying to get many things done to be efficient. And many people find themselves, just because of the stress and the busyness of their life, strangers to themselves. And then there's a whole other set of people who, because being intimate with themselves, being awake, paying attention to what's happening in the present, is very painful. And so the idea of being at home with oneself means to be awake and be clear and be aware of what's happening in one's experience with oneself and the world around us. And as we know, there's a tremendous movement, tremendous tendency in American culture to avoid being present for what's going on. Tremendous rate of alcoholism and drug addiction, drug use, almost all of which is some form or other of saying, well, this present moment is not acceptable. I don't want to be at home in it or be present for it. So I will do something to forget it or avoid it or change who I am. So the idea of being at home with oneself, you know, today it felt very comfortable because I was up there in the nice rainstorm. But what does it mean to be at home with oneself when our personal experiences, the experience of the world around us, are difficult and painful? Meditation practice is not, the mindfulness practice that we're teaching here is not a practice, it's basically a practice about how we hold our experience rather than what kind of experience we have. So the image that comes to my mind, which is used sometimes in meditation, is if you're holding a young baby bird, like you find a little baby bird on the ground and you pick it up, you need to hold it gently enough, but you need to hold it so that it won't fall out of your hands. If your hand is too open, it will, you know, fall out of your hands and hurt itself. But if you hold it too tightly, you're going to hurt the bird also. So you have to hold it with kind of love and care, kind of very gently, with this, you know, with this kind of gentle, nurturing hold. So meditation has a lot to do with how we hold our experience rather than what our experience actually is, which is actually very different from how many people think when they come to do a meditation class. Because most people, when they come to a meditation class, for good reasons, it isn't that they came for the wrong reasons, but come for reasons, for example, they feel too stressed in their life, or they want to cope with something better. They feel more kind of too agitated or too busy or whatever. And so they want to find some way to calm themselves down or to feel better or just cope with the stress of their normal life. Meditation can provide that, but it's best to think of that as a byproduct. Because mindfulness meditation is not about changing anything, but rather is finding a new way to hold what our our experience actually is. To hold it with compassion, to hold it with care, to hold it without reactivity, without pushing it away or grasping onto it like you can't let go of it all, can't change, it can't become something different. So the how we hold ourselves, the how we're present, becomes very important. But maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. The fundamental idea in mindfulness meditation, as in almost in most forms of meditation, involves a deep appreciation for the present moment. This moment that we live in, this moment, the very moment we find ourselves in, is the moment where most of the things that are most precious for us in our life are available to us. I think most of us, if we took a poll, say, what is most important in your life? Those are kinds of things which you only know about, you only experience, if you're in the present for them. Most people don't say that, you know, daydreaming about the past or fantasizing about the future or planning the future are their most precious experiences of their life. But rather it's, you know, it's love, it's compassion, it's friendship, it's beauty, it's being at peace. All these kinds of experience, perhaps, all these kinds of experiences are experiences that are only available if we're in the present moment. So the beginning of meditation practice and the beginning of Buddhist practice, because this meditation practice I'm going to teach you comes out of the Buddhist tradition, is a appreciation for the value of being in the present moment. To take enough time to slow down enough to have it a priority enough to actually, what is actually happening now, right now? What is my experience right now? Rather than being lost in, you know, all the many places we tend to get lost. And lost means that you're not cognizant, you're not aware, you're not present for what is going on. Maybe in retrospect you realized what you were doing, but in the moment there's no consciousness, no presence within that. So the beginning of meditation is this appreciation of the present moment. And for that, the beginning of meditation is learning how to find ourselves in the present moment in the most simple possible way. So the first day of this kind of instructions, we talk about very simple things. We talk mostly about following the breath, being attentive to the breath, using the mindfulness of the breathing, meditation on the breath, as a tool or an aid for helping us come and find ourselves in the present moment. As these weeks go on, what I'll be doing is expanding the instructions to include more and more realms of our life and our experience. Because the idea of mindfulness practice is it's not just simply a meditation practice that's applicable or useful only when you're sitting in formal meditation, but it's a way in which you can bring awareness, bring presence, bring a certain kind of relatedness to all our experiences throughout our day and all our activities. And it's rather arbitrary to distinguish between the mind or the heart in meditation and the one outside. And as a person's meditation deepens, I think naturally there's a tendency to understand, oh, whatever I'm learning in meditation is equally true in my daily life. And then there's an application of the practice into our normal life. So for example, we learn how to be present for ourselves in this very simple posture and simple activity of meditation. And then perhaps you begin to learn, what is it like to be present and mindful as I wash my dishes, or as I drive, or as I'm talking with my friends, or as I do my work, or whatever you're doing, rather than lost in anxiety or fear or fantasy or just in the past or in the future, or in many places we get lost. So we'll expand the instructions, and so today it's very simple. The next week, which is Halloween, we'll do the body, how to include the body and physical experiences into the meditation, and which is a very important one for many of us because the body is a source of great difficulty, either because of our concepts and ideas about it get in the way, or because many of us have pains and difficulties with our body. So how to include those things as part of the meditation is an offering that we give here. And it offers, I think, a radically different way of working with many of our physical experiences than is common in our culture, where, again, taking aspirin or pain medication or, you know, trying to best to avoid it, numb out, is often an operating mode. So next week we include the body. How to include the body in a meditative life, in a mindful life. And then the third day we'll expand it to include emotions. So rather than thinking that emotions are outside the scope of a meditative life or mindfulness, they actually get included within it. And the idea in Buddhist practice is that there's no outside. There's nothing which is outside of what we're willing and can pay attention to. And it's because there's no outside that in Buddhism, the Buddhist understanding is that mindfulness meditation or our awareness itself is sacred. It's a sacred realm or sacred kind of aspect of our life. So we enter into the sacred life by not holding anything outside as being unacceptable. And I think you'll probably notice in yourself, if you start paying attention, probably you notice it in our culture and your friends, how many of us keep parts of our life at a distance. We don't want to look at that. So for example, in myself, when I was younger, I was the kind of person who was not supposed to be angry. So if you're that kind of person, then being angry is kind of unacceptable. And so actually, when I got angry, I'd keep that at a distance. And I wouldn't even recognize that I was angry, because that was unacceptable. That was kept outside. So what do we keep outside? So anyway, so everything is included, and that's kind of the task of these 5 weeks, to show how to include everything within the way in which we hold our experience, how all experiences can be held in an awakeful and a free way. So the third day is emotions. The fourth day will be talking about thoughts and how to include our thinking life within a meditative life. And then the fifth week we'll talk more about how to integrate all this then into a normal life, a daily life. So that's the plan for the next 5 weeks. My name is Gil Fronsdal, and I've been teaching here in Palo Alto, I think, for about 6 years now. I've been doing Buddhist meditation practices for over 20 years, and I did many years as Zen Buddhism, and I was ordained as a Zen priest, a Zen monk, and spent a lot of time in monasteries in Japan and then in Southeast Asia, where I was introduced to the practice I'm teaching you here. The mindfulness practice comes from the Buddhism of Southeast Asia, of Thailand, Burma, and Sri Lanka. And so I practiced there for a long time. And then I came back to this country in the late 80s. And in 1990, I started a graduate school, a graduate doctoral program at Stanford guess what? in Buddhist studies. And so that's my whole life, you know. As Buddhism, it's my dedication. And then the sitting group here started off as a small Monday evening sitting group. When I started with a group, there was about 12 people who came. And then in the 5-6 years we've been here, it's grown steadily. And now just introductory course is quite big. And we meet twice a week. I think most of you might know. We meet Mondays and Thursdays. Thursdays is more the basic meditation practice. I mean, that's what we talk about. And that's when I give the introductory course. And when the introductory course is over, then we continue with talking about kind of basic meditation themes. It's more suited for people newer to meditation, or people who are more kind of want to focus more narrowly on meditation itself. Monday evening is the evening where the people who speak, and myself usually, I might talk about anything that occurs to me that seems remotely connected to a meditation. Sometimes you might wonder what the connection is. And we're connected to other meditation groups in the Bay Area who do teach this practice also. It's quite a large network of other teachers and other groups. And there's out on the table out there, there's some literature about that. There's a newsletter and two newsletters, one for our local group and one bigger one for kind of the Bay Area community. The way in which we teach in this tradition is that the dedication is to teach freely, is not to charge for the teaching. And there's many reasons for that. One of them is because that's the way many of us receive the teachings in Asia, was we were given to it freely. One of the reasons is to make the teachings as available as freely as possible, so people's means don't in any kind of way inhibit the accessibility of receiving the instructions or the teaching. So that's the way it's offered. It's offered freely. However, there's also what we do is we put two baskets out there in the hallway. And they're the equivalent of what in traditional Buddhism is called the monk's begging bowl. And begging, the monk would go around and have a bowl, and the people, the villagers or whatever, would support the monk by putting food or whatever requisites they needed in the bowl. And we're not a monastic community here in America. We're lay people. And so rather than a bowl, we put out this basket. And that's your chance then to support this, whatever we're doing here, whatever way you see it. And there's two baskets. One basket, it says rent. And I think it says dana. Mm-hmm. Dana is the Buddhist word for donation. Both, it means both donation and generosity. So one is for rent, and that is because we have to pay for rent for this room here. And there's no one who's going to pay for it except for us. So that's what it's there for. And if everybody put a dollar in there, that would more than cover pay for the cost for rent. And we have a few other small expenses like the telephone that we keep and things. And then the other basket is for myself or for the teacher, that's usually me. And that is if you want to support what I do. And 95% of my livelihood comes from people making donations for all the I teach all over the place. So that's where my livelihood is from. So it's offered freely, and then there's opportunity for you if you'd like to support so this stuff can, this kind of teaching, this kind of activity can go on. And I find it very interesting. You know, money is a very odd thing in our culture, as many of you know. But that, the way we teach in our tradition is to teach freely. But we experimented once or twice at a large center we have in Marin of charging for the introductory course. And we charged $60 for 6 weeks. And what was very interesting, what's very interesting is that when we don't charge and do it freely this way we do it here, that no matter, even if it's the best meditation teacher who does a course, there's usually 50% of the people drop out by the end. But when we charge $60, there's almost no dropout at all. So what does that mean? What does it mean about how we, what we value and how we value things? And what does it mean? I don't know. So, there's many ways actually of using mindfulness practice. It's been introduced, it's very popular now in the United States. It's particularly become popular in pain and stress reduction clinics. And there's been a whole movement now in hospitals all over to introduce mindfulness-based pain and stress management that comes very directly, it arises, it came out of this Buddhist meditation practice by people who studied the Buddhist practice, extricated, took the practice out of Buddhism and offered in hospital so no one would recognize it as being Buddhism anymore. And, well, it isn't Buddhism anymore, but just it's just a wonderful practice. And so it's possible to do this practice for stress reduction, for pain management. It's possible just to help us cope a little better with our life, our anxiety and problems. It's also a spiritual practice. And it's a very powerful spiritual practice for those who are interested in that part. So you can choose. I mean, it's being offered freely, in a sense, for you to use it as you would like. No one's being asked to become a Buddhist. No one's being asked to take it on as a spiritual practice. But that's certainly part of what is being offered. And those of you who are interested in that part of it can come and talk to me, or we'll find ways to incorporate that aspect into your life or into your practice also. So... Maybe we'll start with talking about posture. So mindfulness meditation is about feeling at home in our presence, is cultivating presence and awareness in the present moment, and somehow feeling composed or at home within ourselves as we experience ourselves and the world around us. To do that, it helps to be somewhat composed or balanced or comfortable in one's posture. Posture is understood in Buddhism to be very important, because posture is kind of an expression of, it has a correspondence of our inner psychological or spiritual tendencies. I think it's no surprise, perhaps, that we have the English word posture for how we hold ourselves, and the word posturing. People here, they're posturing for position, or there's a way in which our posture expresses a lot. So we want to take a posture which helps, is conducive to being both comfortable and at home with ourselves, and also alert. Those two things. And most people, if you think about comfortable posture, it means you kind of sprawl out on the couch. But rather, a comfortable posture is one where the muscles can be aligned and upright, but not tense. So one of the best ways of sitting, traditionally, is to sit on the floor, cross-legged, this way. You don't have to sit this way, but it's fine to sit in a chair, but I'll start by giving instructions for how to sit cross-legged. The idea of sitting cross-legged, the value of it, part of it, is that it gives you a very stable base to sit with, because you have a tripod, you have your two knees and your butt, and tripods are fairly stable ones. And so the stability of the tripod allows you to hold your back up fairly easily compared to almost any other way of sitting. Can someone open the door back there? So the idea, the way to sit cross-legged on the floor is to sit kind of the way that I'm sitting now, if you can see it. And that is to sit with one leg flat in front of the other. There are other ways of sitting, but this I recommend is usually the best way of sitting. With none of the legs not crossing each other, just one in front of the other like this. Part of the reason for this is that it's probably the most symmetrical way of having legs. If we don't sit symmetrically, then there's a tendency of listing to one side. And then if we want to sit straight, so that means you have to kind of straighten out, and then there's kind of a curve in the lower back. You're stretching your body in kind of one side of the body more than others, and that becomes a yoga teacher's nightmare. So you want to sit in a symmetrical way. Now, it's possible to sit the other ways. There's sitting what's called half lotus, putting one foot up on the other thigh. But again, here you're leaning to one side. It's possible to sit full lotus, which is kind of the classic way of sitting, at least in the sculptures, statues. And that's with both the legs up on the thighs. And this is fairly symmetrical, but not as symmetrical as the way I showed you. Most of you can't sit this way. So, this actually works fairly well. In sitting this way, it's best to sit up on a cushion of some sort. Because if you sit flat on the ground, the tendency is for the lower back to cave out. And then the lower back gets tired, and then it gets tired, and then it hurts, and then it goes out. So if you sit up on something, so your hips are higher than your knees, then it creates a little bit of curve in the lower part of your back. So it's easier to stay upright for some time. And also it allows you to tip the pelvis forward a little bit. If the pelvis goes forward, kind of tips forward, it's easier to get the knees down and have that tripod. So there's various ways of sitting. Many people like to sit on these round cushions called zafus, and they're available. Allison here, she actually sells them. She has kind of a mail order or whatever, and it's probably the cheapest way of getting it in this area is to get it from Allison. But it's to sit on these round ones. What you want to do is, most people have a tendency of sitting right up on top, The idea is to sit on the front third of it, so that it kind of, because then you're sitting on the slant, so it tips the pelvis forward and creates a little bit of a curve in the lower back. If you can't get your knees down, then you can experiment with sitting higher. If your hips are usually it's a matter of opening the hips, not of stretching the knees. If the hips are too tight, then it's hard to get the knees down. But if you sit higher you are, the easier you get the knees down. But there's a trade-off, because at some point you're sitting so high it becomes a slide, and you slide off. And if it wasn't for the sliding effect, all of us can sit this way, but at a certain height. So you can experiment with different heights. There's also using, some people like to sit on knees, crescent moon pillows. And that's one, it's just another way of sitting, which is sometimes nice. If you can't get your knees down, but you're sitting more or less this way, what you can do, like for you, you could probably do it if you sat a little bit higher. But if you couldn't, what you could do is you can put some, this is too fat, but you can put something and prop it up underneath your knee, so your knee's not hanging in the air. And so that kind of can take some of the strain off. So then we want to sit in a way that your back is straight. Again, there's a correspondence with our inner life and with the way we hold our posture. And because of that, the encouragement in Buddhism, at least, is not to use a backrest when you meditate. Because the idea in Buddhism is to become self-reliant. And if you're not being self-reliant physically, it's a little bit harder to find that inner self-reliance. But if you need to use a backrest, there's no problem with using it. And many people need to use it, and it's fine to use it. But if it's possible to avoid it, then it's best to avoid it. Don't just use a backrest because you're lazy. So the idea is to have the back straight. And there's various ways to help you. You can take both hands or fists and put them either side of your hips on the ground and lift yourself almost off your cushion. And then have your chest come up. And then as you let go, let your shoulders roll back. And then you'll find yourself, I think, sitting a little bit more upright and easier and more open and more comfortable. Do you want to try this? Because there's extra. It's extra. Yeah, please. There's two of them here, if anybody else wants to try. And then it's nice to keep the head balanced on the shoulders, which means not having the head sticking forward too much or leaning to one side, but rather having it balanced. And the usual instructions is to take the chin and tuck it back and down slightly. And partly that instruction arises because when people think a lot in meditation, sometimes their chin goes up like this. And it's said that if you keep your chin down slightly, it controls the excessive mind that thinks too much. Though you won't believe it. And another way of saying that is you create a little bit of space between the last vertebrae and your skull. It can help a little bit. In our tradition, we meditate with the eyes closed, and we just gently close the eyes. And the mouth is kept closed, and it's best to keep the tongue resting up against the roof of the mouth. The hands can be in any posture, which is symmetrical. The usual Buddhist way is to have your hands together in front of you. And they can be resting on your heels, or it can be held up by themselves. Some people prefer to have them held up kind of in front of your belly button. Some people, if they sit this way, the way I've recommended, and have their hands on their ankle or on their heel, there's a tendency for the arms to pull the shoulders forward, and it puts kind of strain on the shoulders. And then what you can do is take a little pillow or something, or roll up a towel, and put it on your foot to hold your hands up a little bit higher. Or you can have your hands on your thighs, kind of on your knees, up or down or whatever way you want to sit. If you're sitting in a chair, again, it's best, if it's possible, not to use the backrest, but to sit away from the backrest. It's fine to use the backrest if you need to. If you need to use a backrest, The preferred way is to use something that supports only your lower back. So, you know, if you kind of press hard up against a kind of a cushion against your lower back, and that some you get this kind of very strong feeling in your lower back that keeps your upper back kind of easily supported and upright. You want to kind of mimic that if you have to use a backrest. Some people have to use the backrest for the whole back, and that's fine also. You can do mindfulness in any posture at all. You can do it lying down. Some people can only do it lying down because they can't even sit. When you're sitting on a chair, it's best to have your knees lower than your hips. Sometimes people like to put a little cushion on their chair so they can kind of raise up a little bit. You want to have both feet squarely on the floor, kind of, so you're sitting in a solid way, both feet kind of parallel and squarely on the floor. And sit high enough so you get that little bit of strength or curve in the lower part of the back. That's why sometimes a little cushion can help. You certainly don't want to sit in such a way that you tend to slump out, so that puts a real strain on your back. And the rest is the same, keeping your back upright and your hands in whatever way you want and your eyes closed. The idea is to be comfortable, but the idea is to be both comfortable and alert, and to take a posture that feels alert, but also doesn't put a strain or puts tension on your body. So any questions about the posture? Anybody have any particular concerns? Yes?
Can the hands rest on the knees, did you say?
You can rest them on the knees. There's a tendency sometimes, if they're on their knees themselves, it tends to pull the shoulders forward also. So you might experiment, and it might be better to have for you to have them a little bit further back. But that's... Yes?
In the event of severe discomfort, as if there could be a try to shift a bit or focus on that pain.
Uh-huh. We'll talk about that next week.
So,
until then, don't have any. but until then, you're welcome to shift your posture and make yourself comfortable again. There's the idea of coming home and being intimate with oneself, being settled on oneself, being quite present in the present moment in a continuous fashion, is helped greatly by holding the body still. It's not like you don't need to hold the body still, but it really helps. So in formal meditation practice, it's really helpful to try to maintain the body still. So learning how to include discomfort as part of the meditation then becomes important, rather than always running away from it. And some people will constantly fidget, constantly try to never find the right posture and always kind of adjust, and you'll never really settle on yourself. So for now, you can change your posture, and then next week the instructions might help. Yes? Like that.
Half or third?
Oh, sitting in the front half or the front third. There's quite a slope there. So you can just sit as you... I mean, I don't have a good sense except experiment. Yes?
For those of us who are still working on our flexibility,
uh-huh,
but can sit comfortably, for example, with one knee, uh-huh, back, is that an acceptable alternative?
It's completely acceptable. And actually in... Thailand, that's the way women meditate, is sitting that way there. That's the women's meditation posture. There's other ways of sitting on the floor. One is you can take a pillow like this. And put it between your ankles. And sit down. So you're sitting on your knees. Sitting up on this. And also, this is a nice alternative. If you're getting tired of sitting cross-legged, you can sit this way. And some people sit on benches. Anybody have a bench today? There's these meditation benches you'll see sometimes, and they allow you to sit on your knees this way also, but they support all your weight, so you don't have less weight on your ankles and your knees. Anything else about posture?
Does it matter which leg goes in front?
It doesn't matter so much, unless you're a yoga teacher. And the yoga teacher, what the yoga teacher would say, is every other time you meditate, you should alternate legs. Because even though it's relatively symmetrical, it's not completely. And you create a little imbalance if you're always sitting the same way. So yoga teachers are kind of like your moms, you know. They usually know better, but you take their advice. So I leave it for you. And those of you in the chair, are you comfortable enough? You have the idea? So why don't we try it? We've been sitting for a while now, so if you want to take a moment, a minute or so to stand, just to stretch, and then I'll give you the first instruction. For the last many years, I've kept my glasses on when I meditate. But the first 10 years of my meditation, I always took them off. So, it's up to you.
Alternate every 10 years.
And jewelry, you know, some of these questions are good questions. But the spirit of mindfulness meditation is somewhat in the spirit of experimentation, investigation, of trial and error, where you become your own kind of authority for what works for you, rather than hearing from someone else, how you do the practice. Actually, no one can. I believe no one can really teach you how to do mindfulness. The instructions I give you is really is really pretty cursory. And really, the way that you learn is by trying it yourself, and then it becomes kind of a trial and error and finding out what works for me and how do I find my way to be most awake, most intimate, most present.
What kind of first about lying down? You just mentioned, by the way, if you do anything sitting or even lying down. I prefer to lie down. I would like to know if this is just as effective in meditation.
It can be just as effective. What the tendency is when we lay down is to fall asleep. It's a lot easier to fall asleep. If you never fall asleep, then it's less of a problem laying down. Some people need to do their meditation laying down, so it's fine. But if you don't fall asleep, it's more or less it's a fine thing to do. There are some other advantages to sitting this way. I don't feel like going into them. There are more pragmatic advantages, nothing absolute. But there are some advantages to sitting this way to almost any other posture. But if it works much better for you to lie down, please. But the interesting question is, how are you measuring how it works for you? That's the question. Because some people measure success of meditation by becoming calm or relaxed. And that's fine if you want to do that. But the point of this meditation is necessarily just to become calm or relaxed. The point of the meditation, because that's an experience, that's a way of being. The point of mindfulness is how do you hold your experience? So, for example, if I'm feeling angry, can I hold that anger in a gentle, accepting way? Or do I hate the anger and hate myself for being angry and desperately try to push it away or ignore it or repress it or blame myself for it or do I indulge in it and validate everything about it and validate myself for being angry and create an ideology to go with it? That's not a kind of open-handed kind of free relationship with it. It's the way we hold it's important. So, if something about our present life is unacceptable to us and we're trying to change it, we haven't really learned how to hold it in a new way. So what happens when people use meditation to become calm and relaxed, which is a fine thing to do, but you notice that if you do that, then you might hold the calmness, the calm state, with a little bit of attachment. And that little bit of attachment, at some point, if you do mindfulness practice in a consistent way and really mature in the practice, at some point or other, that little bit of attachment to calm, you'll realize that it's not to your best interest, and you'll let go of it. But it might, sometimes it takes a while to realize that. Okay, so take a posture which is upright, alert, but comfortable. And close your eyes. And then at the beginning of a period of meditation, it's often nice to take a few deep breaths, two or three or four, using the breath to connect to your body as you breathe in. And as you breathe out, relaxing, letting go. And then after a few deep breaths, you can breathe normally. And it's very important to realize that in mindfulness meditation, there's no particular way to breathe. It's fine to breathe whatever way you happen to be breathing when you sit down to pay attention to your breath. And then also at the beginning of a sitting, it's nice to go through your body and relax the larger muscle groups in the body that might be tense. So for example, you might start at the top of your body and relax your forehead. You might relax your eyes. It's nice to relax the shoulders. They might not relax much. They don't have to, but if it's easy, you can just let go. And sometimes you can relax and soften the stomach. Let the stomach hang out. It's considered inappropriate in our culture to have the stomach hang out, but in the culture of meditation, it's considered to be advantageous to let the stomach be soft. And then sitting here, how is it that your body experiences itself? As if the whole body was an organ of awareness, of perception. Can you drop down into your body and feel the body's experience of itself? Feeling the sense of presence within the body. And then within the body, as part of the body, and you become now aware of your breathing. Not so much thinking about the breath, but how does the breath experience itself? Where in your body are the sensations that tell you that you're breathing? And if you have trouble finding your experience of breathing in your body, you can put your hand on your abdomen and feel the rising and falling as you breathe. So as you find yourself breathing, let your awareness rest itself in this experience of breathing. As the mind wanders away and thinks and gets distracted, whenever you notice that, come back and bring your sense of being at home, being present. You're bringing back your awareness. And whenever your mind wanders away or gets distracted, that's fine. There's no need to judge it or be concerned. Even if for 1,000 times in a period of sitting your mind wanders away, what's important is that each time you notice it, that you gently, softly settle the awareness again on the breath, using the breath as a way of being in the present moment, cultivating presence, cultivating the ability to be present by connecting with your breathing. The spirit of meditation is to be very simple, with no expectation of what's to happen, not trying to make anything happen, except being present, resting in the presence of the breath, like you'd rest in the presence of the beloved. allowing yourself to let go of your thoughts and concerns, allowing yourself to be very simple, feeling this in-breath, feeling this out-breath. Letting your awareness follow the breath, feeling the breath within the breath, within the body. Following the in-breath, following the out-breath. And there's no need to worry about how well you're doing. Just whenever you remember, come back to the breathing. As if the breath was going to guide you. Be your guide. And then we'll continue one last minute. In this last minute, be as intimate as you can with the experience of breathing. So this very simple beginning of simply being with the breath, following the breath, sensing the breath, returning to the breath whenever the mind gets distracted, does a few different things. On the one hand, it's just simply cultivating our ability to be in the present moment. We're choosing something very simple, something we do all the time, and we're just choosing this thing just to develop and cultivate and become familiar with being in the present moment, to strengthen this capacity that we all have, the capacity to be attentive, to pay attention. There's nothing really mysterious or mystical particularly about meditation. It's really strengthening this ability to pay careful attention. So just simply developing that ability on this simple thing called the breath. Something else happens, though, and that is that if you do this very simple thing, just following the breath, we begin to leave ourselves alone in a way that I think is unfamiliar for many of us. Many people are not leaving themselves alone or leaving a situation alone. They are either, many of us are critical of ourselves or upset about ourselves or planning tomorrow or upset about something or desiring something or confused or agitated or anxious, or we do all this stuff that is not which kind of perpetuates cycles of further anxiety, further suffering, further preoccupations. And then there's always a subtle movement of trying to fix things, to be in control, to make things a little bit better, or to hold on to this pleasure a little bit more, to control the situation, to make, you know. And these constant movements create strain. The definition of stress, in a sense, or what stress, nothing in the world causes stress for us. What stress is, in a simplest way from a Buddhist point of view, is when our awareness, our attention, gets fixated on something. And so it gets kind of narrow and constrained and constricted. And it's that narrowness and constriction, constraining of awareness, that gets translated into our body, into our mind, into our heart, into our emotions, and we get this thing called stress. But if the awareness can be left free and unconstricted, nothing actually would cause us stress, because we wouldn't receive anything in a way that, again, it's a matter of how we hold things, how we receive things. So many of us are constantly doing things to ourselves and adjusting things and figuring things out or worrying about things. But just following the breath in a very simple way, our primary activity then is something so, you know, about the, a simple thing you can possibly do, which we do all the time anyway. And so the normal, our consciousness is not so preoccupied with all these other activities of manipulation, of concern, of changing, of holding off or protecting or becoming something. And so we say in meditation that we're leaving ourselves completely alone. We're not interfering with ourselves. And this act of leaving ourselves alone is a great relief. Because if we can leave ourselves alone, all the forms of tension and strain that we build up begins to kind of naturally fall away. It's like everything, our strain, the stresses of our life, in order for them to stay in place, we have to constantly be turning the spring. If we pull out the key from the spring will naturally kind of just release itself. If we can just leave ourselves alone in a complete way, then a kind of more natural state begins to arise in its, by itself. By being very attentive in a restful way, easeful way with the breath, without straining with the breath, not worrying if you get distracted, just coming back to the breath and being as easeful and as present as you can, it allows for a much stronger experience, much stronger possibility of leaving ourselves alone than almost anything else we can do in our life. And so it's a very wonderful healing thing to do, to just leave ourselves alone by being with the breath. What that means, leaving ourselves alone, means we don't worry about any other way, any experiences, any way we feel, or any kind of thoughts or feelings we have when we meditate. They're all fine. Everything is fine for meditation. Isn't that nice? Whatever way you are at a given moment is completely acceptable from the point of view of meditation. It's like your best friend. Nothing about you is guilty or shameful or bad or upsetting or anything. Nothing is unacceptable from a meditative point of view, it just, oh, I'll go back to the breath. You just be with the breath. Be very simple. Allow it all to be there. Leave yourself alone and see how things change. See how things, the springs unwind. It's like pulling the plug from the bathtub and the water drains away. So it's very simple. So those two things, you're cultivating the ability to be present and you're leaving yourself alone. Beautiful things to be doing for our lives. How was it to sit those few minutes for you? What was it like and what did you notice?
My eyes
teared up. Teared up?
My eyes teared.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that happens. And you don't have to worry about that. Just let them tear. Let the tears come if that's what happens. And just for now, just continue with your breathing. If something strong happens in your meditation, nothing to worry about. For now, especially now since we're still focusing on the breath, you can include that experience within the breath if something comes really strong.
My breath comes deeper and slower,
uh-huh.
And I'm concerned about bothering people around me.
You don't have to worry. It's a little bit early for me to tell you this. I kind of spring it on you after a couple of sessions. But actually, there's no such thing as a distraction when you do mindfulness practice. And why I can say that will become clear in a few sessions. So you don't have to worry about distracting people because you can't. There's no such thing as a distraction. Yes?
I find a tendency to nod off at night, but not ever practically in the morning. Never in the morning.
Oh, that makes sense. I mean, we're tired. So most people find if you meditate only once a day, most people find it's best to do it in the morning. Often when you first wake up in the morning and before the telephones start ringing or before you kind of gear up and when you're still kind of rested but still kind of settled and quiet. And also the environment is quiet. Some people prefer to do it in the evening. Some people will do it both morning and evening. And if you do it in the evening or the end of the day, sometimes often the body and the mind is kind of tired. And what I found was very interesting. I used to work at a kind of a fast food restaurant. And then I would meditate in the morning and meditate in the evening. And in the morning, I'd be quite present. I wouldn't fall asleep. But in the evening, I meditated 40 minutes when I came back from work, like around 6 o'clock. The first 20 minutes, I'd be kind of nodding off and falling asleep. And it was just all the tiredness and the strain or whatever of the day, which just kind of was there. And because I was leaving myself alone and not feeding it, I'm not trying to keep myself up and active and hypered and distracted and everything, then that's what happens. The tiredness has a chance to kind of reveal itself. And I kind of nod off and be really tired for a while. And after about 20 minutes, that had processed itself. In the second 20 minutes, I'd be alert. Because I needed to kind of have that little rest. So I wouldn't worry about it, and nodding off is often.
How do you then? That fits with my foot fell asleep. My leg fell asleep.
Yes.
And then I was afraid of distracting everybody if I knew that was going on. But so how do I incorporate that? What do I do with that?
Okay. Next week I'll talk about how to include physical sensations, and that's one. But a foot falling asleep, there's other things to be said about the basic instructions. And that is, it's quite common for people when they first start sitting this way for the legs to fall asleep. It's partly because the circulation is not used to the kind of particular kinds of pressures. With time, your circulation will find new routes or adjust. And most people find within either a couple of weeks or a couple of months it's not a problem anymore. Occasionally it becomes a persistent problem and some people just learn to live with it and it's not a problem. If the sensations come back within 2 or 3 minutes, then you're cutting the blood flow. If the numbness persists more than 5 minutes, then it's probably you're pinching on a nerve. And you never want to pinch a nerve or press on a nerve. So if the numbness takes more than 5 minutes for you to recover from it, then you need to talk to me or find another way of sitting so that doesn't happen anymore. You're welcome to change your posture. You know, you can just move slowly if you need to, if it's uncomfortable. If it's not uncomfortable, just let it be. And just don't stand up quickly. Small adjustments in posture can make a big difference in how the legs fall asleep. So you might experiment with sitting a little bit higher, a little bit lower, a little bit farther forward in the cushion. Sitting a little bit different is just even, you know, half an inch a little bit different with the feet apart or together or something can make a big difference. Sometimes the calf and the thighs press against each other, and you can go in here behind your knee and lift this up as you sit down, pulling this apart, and that can help. Some people, when their feet just a foot fall asleep, you can put a little towel underneath your ankle and prop it up, and it makes a nice more curve. Sitting on a cushion, like a few people have, like that, a real soft one, can make it easier, because even though this is relatively, I mean, softer than a hardwood floor, it's still hard enough for some people that it can cut the circulation.
My stomach, I'm used to holding it in.
Yes.
When I was breathing, I was trying to let it be, but I didn't know what to do with it, to tell you the truth, because I know the diaphragm is supposed to go up and down.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know what my stomach was supposed to do with that.
Uh-huh.
And so I would find it tightening again,
uh-huh.
and then I'd yeah. let it hang out, but... Maybe you could explain that whole process of breathing.
But you breathe whatever way you happen to breathe. You don't have to worry about how you're breathing. Let the breath just do itself, whatever way it wants to do. There's no right breath. You don't have to breathe slow and deep or fast and shallow. Or you don't have to do like anything. You just let it breathe the way it wants to breathe. Sometimes it's fast, sometimes slow, sometimes in the chest, sometimes in the stomach. Just your job is to be aware of how it is. But a lot of people in our culture hold our stomach in for many reasons. Some people are taught to hold their stomach in. Some people hold them in because they're of fear or anger or whatever. To hold this area soft just makes it a lot easier to be relaxed in our life, to be centered in our life. Because there's a tendency when we hold tension all the time, the part of our body that's tense tends to become numb. And so if this area becomes numb, then a kind of our center of presence is kind of up, kind of rather than kind of grounded in a way. Now, many people hold their stomach in and it's tense. So you don't want to worry. Anything you learn from meditation should not be a source for worrying about. The point of meditation is stop worrying. So don't allow anything you ever hear from a meditation teacher or any instructions you ever get or anything that happens to you in meditation be a source of worry. So don't worry about it, anything. But so what usually, but it's nice to hold the stomach relaxed. You don't want to make a big deal of it. What's usually good at the beginning of the meditation, just see if you can relax it, let it hang, and then probably what will happen is it'll tighten up pretty quickly. Then don't worry about it until your next meditation period. And then at the beginning, just let it relax. And slowly with time, you'll train your stomach to be relaxed. And eventually it'll be a delight to have a stomach. Yes? For those of you, I think that a nice length of time is about half an hour. However, those of you who are new to meditation might want to start with less than that. You might want to start with 15 minutes, and then for the next 3 weeks or something, once a week, add 5 minutes. So this week 15, next minute 20, 25, and then 30. But the length of time varies a little bit depending on what you can fit into your life. You do something which is realistic. For some people, half an hour is unrealistic given how busy they are. And so they start with great intention to sit for half an hour, but they can never do it. So it's better to kind of discern what can I actually do. And so even if you sit for 15 minutes or 10 minutes, it's actually beneficial. So find something you can do. What's more important than how long you sit is, or when you sit, you know, what's important is having some kind of commitment to a regular practice. The tendency for people is to sit either when they're feeling really good or to sit and meditate when they're feeling really lousy. But the idea of meditation is to sit with ourselves as we are, and without preference for good or bad, or whether difficult or things are wonderful, just to sit with ourselves. And so if you make a commitment to sit every day for, say, a certain length of time, like every day I'm going to sit for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or half an hour, then regardless of what happens in your life, you'll end up on the cushion sitting. And over a long period of time, the whole range of your humanity, of your life, will be processed through this wonderful thing of meditation and mindfulness. But if you're picking and choosing when to meditate, then part of your life is not being processed. It's being held outside this realm. So you choose some length of time that you think you can consistently keep up. And if you can keep it up every day, then that's really great. And you know, to do at least, you know, whatever that takes. To only do it once, you know, once a week, I mean, people will do it, and because it has benefit. I don't think anybody would do it if they didn't feel like it was useful. But once a week doesn't really allow the power of the practice to really penetrate into us. The power of the practice doesn't happen in the short term. It's not something like you sit for 2 days and nothing's happened, so I'm not enlightened yet, so, you know, I'm gonna, maybe I'll go try something else. There's a continuity of kind of a strength that arises from the continuity. And the continuity builds over the months. And rather than judging it by what happens in 1 or 2 days or any given day, maybe you can, after 6 months, you can review. Or what you do is after 6 months, you stop meditating for a week. And you'll notice how profound it is in your life. Sometimes there's a tendency where if you sit every day, that it kind of creeps up on you, the beneficial effects, and you don't really notice. So you do it for 6 months, and then you try stopping for a week, and you'll see how consequential it is. Yeah.
I just want to comment on that we live in an instant society, and it's so much of a desire to, like, and part of Buddhism is giving up desires. It's just like we want it quickly to have that peace of mind.
Yeah. This practice is called insight meditation. It's one of the formal words for it. And one of the first insights that we have is that the mind is out of control. And so what often happens, people come to me and say, I can't do this meditation because I meditate and I realize my mind is just, my thoughts are just all over the place and I'm scattered and I can't be present and I can't be with the breath more than, twice in the whole sitting, and it's just crazy in there. And, and I can't sit. Whereas I hear that and I say, congratulations, you've reached the first stage of insight. You've realized something. You've understood. You have insight. Oh, this is how the mind works. So don't worry. And don't worry about the movements for instant gratification. Don't worry about anything as long as you keep coming back. As long as you keep coming back and keep coming back to the present, coming back to the breath, and just... And as we go along in the instructions over this next weeks, you'll learn actually more carefully how to bring attention actually to the very things which make it difficult for you to be present. So, we start with this very simple thing of following the breath and leaving ourselves alone. And we always leave ourselves alone in meditation, in a sense. But the very things which make it difficult for us to meditate are picked up as the subject of meditation. So it's really delightful, delicious, the practice. What else? Anything else? Comments, concerns, objections, fears?
Oh, I have a question.
Yeah.
So, since I've never done this, if I do it at home, does it need to be quiet?
It's best. It's pragmatically best to have a quiet environment where you're not going to be disturbed, especially before you get the full instructions and you learn how nothing is an instruction. But even so, it's usually best to find a quiet time, because just usually best. Some people wonder how you keep time. And there's various ways. I mean, one way is just to look at your watch, but that tends to be kind of, every 5 minutes you're looking, is it over yet? Every minute, But one way is to, what I did was, I don't know if they're available anymore, I went to a drugstore and got an old-fashioned wound-up clock that if you wind it up, and if you set the alarm, but don't turn it on. Then when the minute hand gets around to that place, the alarm clock clicks. And that was just, oh, click, time to get up. Some people will tape, with the cassette tape, they'll tape half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever, however long you sit, of silence. And then and at the end of that taped silence, they ring a little bell. And so then when they go and meditate, they just stick the cassette into the tape recorder, and they sit there in silence, and then after half an hour, you hear this ping, ping, and then you rewind the tape and have it ready for the next day.
There are also tapes that have bells at random times or space times that you can buy.
Uh-huh. So you can, they're done for you.
For $10, you can get a little cooking timer that's electronic, so it doesn't make any sound at all.
It has a nice...
For 30 minutes or an hour.
And it has a nice sound?
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's... Yeah. So. And yes.
Well, I just wondered if you had any other suggestions about how to make a habit of daily meditation. I have a question
about that. One is feeling that it's important enough for you, a priority enough. And how you figure out that it's high enough priority is really up to you. Hopefully the instructions I give and what I say about it somehow resonates enough that you for yourself realize, oh, this is something I want to at least try out, and it's important enough for me to try out. So being clear on your priorities and what's important for you in your life, and not getting distracted by all kinds of superficial priorities, kind of, it's common enough, you sit down and meditate and you realize, oh, I have to clean the refrigerator. And that becomes much more important than meditating. And so not allowing such things to kind of get in the way. But having a set time, if it's possible, where that's your meditation time, it also can help to have a set place in your house. Sometimes, like in a bedroom or something, if you take a corner, and that corner is the only thing that happens in that corner is meditation. So it has associations, and you keep it there so that it's always reminding you. And it has associated, makes it a little bit easier to go and make that a possibility. So, I don't know. Just do it.
I just want to lose all sense of where, like when your hands are together, where one hand stops and the other one begins.
Uh-huh.
Like they're all together.
Uh-huh. When you're meditating.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happens, this is a little bit getting ahead of ourselves for many people who are new, but one of the ways in which the mind works, it creates concepts of things. And the concepts of things is often what we're relating to, not what's directly happening. And concepts, to some degree, are flexible. They can be flexible. So, for example, the difference between sometimes a stool is a footstool, and sometimes the same stool is a stool to sit on. You know, we have a concept we can apply to it. Or sometimes a table is a table, and sometimes a table is a massage table, and sometimes the table is a work table. And sometimes, you know, so I don't know if I'm making the point, but to some certain degree, concepts are more arbitrary than most people realize. So, but often the mind makes concepts of things, and then it relates to the concept. What happens in meditation when we get very quiet, that functioning of the mind gets put a little bit to rest, and we begin to experience how things are experienced directly, unmediated by concepts. When we experience things unmediated by concepts, then the normal conceptual understanding of things begins to dissolve. And sometimes in meditation, then we have kind of strange experiences, like you feel you don't see the beginning and the end of the hands. Or suddenly you feel like, anyway, it can be kind of unusual experiences happen in the body because we're not processing it through our normal concepts, and just not to worry about. It's actually considered very useful. It's very important in mindfulness to learn the difference between how something actually is and what we think it is. And that's part of one of the insights that gets developed as we go into this and go deeper into it. To distinguish between the actual experience and our interpretation of the experience, the concept we have of the experience. And so what your example, you mean you're able to relax enough so you're not adding concepts to your hand all the time. And if you're not adding concepts to your hand, the normal ones, then the normal boundaries between the hands will, to some degree, begin to dissolve. Does that make sense? Yes?
Is there anything special to think about if you're going to start a meditation practice with your partner or spouse?
Well, one of the things you should be clear about is your partner really wants to do it, and don't try to kind of finagle them into doing it or tell them that what a good idea it is, or you know. But if they want to do it, I don't know.
So sitting together is not a bad thing. It's not like you go to different parts of the house.
I don't know. It depends. Different people do it. I think it's nice to sit with someone, have company, and I think it's very supportive to sit with people. But I know people who sit. Couples and they sit in different rooms, or it's actually fairly common that I know of, and it seems to be a relaxed thing. They like sitting in different places in the house, and so that's what they do. And my wife and I, we sit together usually. I usually sit down first, and then sooner or later she joins me. And you know, I don't have anything particular to say. It's nice to have support. It's very nice to come to a weekly sitting group. I think that's one way to help sustain a regular meditation practice, is to come to a weekly sitting group, because there's a tremendous amount of support and encouragement and learning that happens just with sitting with other people. So you're welcome to come here Wednesday or Thursday or Monday, or there's other sitting groups around. There's a Zen center in Mountain View, and there's sitting groups all over the place now in San Jose. And so find something that's compatible for you and get some, you know. Yes?
Is there a text that you would suggest?
There's several, four or five very nice introductory, kind of more or less introductory books in mindfulness. This practice is called mindfulness meditation, sometimes called insight meditation. The Buddhist word is vipassana. Vipassana means literally clear seeing. Or special seeing. Two very basic, nice books. One is called The Experience of Insight by Joseph Goldstein. Another one is A Gradual Awakening by Stephen Levine. And a third one, which is very nice, it came out recently, and very moving, because this person, the first two are more like instructions. The third one I'll say now is... he gives a lot of instructions, but also it's a lot of his personal account of how it was for him to practice and his great difficulties with his practice, and he had a very traumatic life. And it's called In the Lap of the Buddha by Gavin Harrison. And all three books should be easy to find. And they're quite readable. Yes? It's kind of fallen away from this course. I used to do it, and I haven't for a couple of years. What I usually do then, what happens is I do the 5 weeks, and then the weeks after that, I just continue for those who want to keep coming. And so then I just kind of continue with further instructions. And then usually at some point or other, I'll cover walking meditation. But it's so... Maybe I'm not doing the job as the way I should, but it's the way it goes. There's Allison sells also tapes of talks and stuff that I give, and one of the tapes she sells, well, a series, she sells tapes from one of the introductory courses from a year or two ago. So if you miss one of these, you could pick up that particular day from some years ago. It's basically the same stuff. And one, I think you also in that series you have one on walking meditation. Yeah. So if you can't wait, get the tape. breath is mindfulness of the breathing is very useful to do, not only as a meditation practice, but as a grounding technique throughout your day. If you find yourself at the Safeway in your supermarket line, nothing else to do but look at the National Enquirer, then instead you might just sit there and just follow your breath, stand there and be with your breath. Or if you're at the stop light, just be with your breath a little bit. Or take a few minutes in the middle of the day at work and just take it's called a breather, right? take a couple of minutes just to be very gently, softly with your breath. And it's very helpful, I think, of doing those two things. Strengthen your presence and leaving yourself alone and kind of relaxing a little bit. Any other concerns or questions? It's this core. So as you say, mindfulness practice doesn't require you to meditate formally this way. You can do mindfulness practice without just using this as a tool in your daily life. And the instructions over the next weeks will really show you how it can be a tool in your daily life. So you don't have to do the meditation if you don't, want to do it. But it really works best. And the way that this kind of course, five-week course, works best is if you do follow the instructions for the week and apply it at home once a day at home at least. So for this next week, if you're new, sit for 15 minutes. If you're not new, you might sit for longer. And just really focus on mindfulness of the breathing. Being at ease, being simple, not worrying about anything, just coming back to the breath, being with the breath, not worrying about being, scattered most of the time. Whenever you remember, come back to the breath. And then if you do that for this 1 week, then it'll become easier to incorporate the instructions for next week when we talk about how to include the body. And also, I'm very eager to get some feedback from people about how it is as you try this out. You can just be some feedback or some, reports of how it is, or a little bit your difficulties or the delights about it or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that I know, so we can kind of speak to your concerns and where you're at, rather than just kind of me going on and on and on. So at the beginning of each class, I'll ask anybody, if anybody has any comments or reports or something you want to say. Okay? So thank you all.